A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
This is Arscast Extra.
Hello and welcome to another Arscast Extra, as always, with James from Gunnerblog. James, goodly afternoon to you. No, sorry, badly afternoon to you. And I'm not wishing you a badly afternoon, it just is one, as you can see by me getting completely mixed up with what I was going to say at the start of this podcast.
Hey, it happens. I've had quite a few days.
Tell me.
Because I was in Manchester, obviously, on Thursday. Then I went to the Women's FA Cup final on Sunday. For those who don't know, Arsenal were roundly trounced by Chelsea. And then the following day, went up to Goodison Park to watch Arsenal play Everton. I mean, it's a real case of McNicholas gets battered everywhere he goes at the moment.
Stay away. Stay away.
Yeah.
Are you going on Saturday?
Afraid so.
Don't.
I mean, you know, I get messages from people saying, you've got the best job in the world. And I'm like, yeah, sometimes. Sometimes.
Yeah, yeah.
But other people, you know, other times it is tough, you know, because you've got, not only do you have to watch the games, you've got to pick them apart, you've got to write about them, you've got to talk about them. They live with you for a very long time.
That is true. I was lying in bed this morning, you know, that period where between the where you wake up first and you doze off again, and I was having a dream about the terrible problems I was having of writing the blog, where I was going, what am I going to say? You know that dream where you sort of, you've dreamt you've done your homework and you haven't? It was that kind of thing. And I dreamt I was struggling. What am I going to say? And I'd almost got to the end of the blog and I was very happy with what I'd written. And then I woke up and I had to get up and write about it.
Tough. It is. I dream about it too. Yeah. I dream about it too. Football haunts my dreams. But I am home. I'm here. So, yeah, let's chat about it.
Okay, let's do it. Before we get into the match chat side of things, because we are going to have to do that, I just want to talk about something because I think it is worth talking about, but I want to keep it completely separate from the way we played, our performance, you know, our football, the issues that we have as a football team. But I think it's important to talk about the incident with Tomiyasu and Ben Godfrey and Mike Dean, because I think it's absolutely disgraceful and outrageous that a professional footballer can land studs first on the face of another player when he absolutely 100% meant to do it. He absolutely did. Carragher said it. Neville said it on Sky. You could see in the incident itself. And even whether he meant to do it or not, the fact that he did it, and it was looked at by VAR and Mike Dean, and no action was taken, not a yellow card, not a red card. I mean, it should have been a red card. We all know that should have been a red card. Is an absolutely disgraceful decision from Mike Dean, not for the first time this season either, because if you think back a few weeks when we played Crystal Palace, James McArthur, absolutely booted Bukayo Saka with the ball nowhere near him. And again, Mike Dean was the referee. That's a stone cold. I mean, that was the biggest red card of the season until that one last night that wasn't given. It's maddening and crazy. And I'm saying this to get it out of the way. It could have been different. It wasn't different. So we have to deal with the reality. And, you know, Godfrey getting sent off doesn't make us any better at playing football, but I still think you have to address these issues. I just do not understand. We saw Jude Bellingham, you know, talk at the weekend about issues with the referee in the Dortmund-Bayern game. I'm not saying that an Arsenal player should have come out and said something like that, but you know, Bukayo Saka got kicked all over the place last night, and we didn't really do anything, and we didn't do anything when Tomiyasu got clattered, and we didn't do anything when Nuno got a really bad tackle on him in the second half as well. And I just wish we would fucking stand up for ourselves a bit in situations like that. The refereeing was terrible, but fuck me. Come on, let's just be... I don't know. I'm sort of losing the run of myself here. I don't quite know how to express it, but I find it hard to take that when we are being targeted, and, you know, Saka booted up and down the place yesterday, and not for the first time this season either. We need to protect him if the referees won't. We need to make more of these situations, because right now it's just too fucking easy to give decisions or not give decisions in our favor, because I don't know. Just be more upfront about things like this. So, yeah, I just wanted to rant about that for a sec.
That's fair enough. Imagine if, after our chat about Jamal Lascelles and Gabriel Martinelli the other week, I said, actually, I thought it was fine, that challenge. I thought it was, he's going for the boys. You know, you want to take that out of the game. No, I mean, obviously, that one was an undeniable red card. As much as I enjoy sort of rounding on Mike Dean, and bear in mind, I haven't seen TV coverage. I was in the press box with access to some replays and just got home. Surely this is all on the video assistant referee. I mean, it didn't go to Mike Dean for a review, did it?
So I thought they said that it did.
Oh, did they?
I think that's what they said on the TV last night, that Mike Dean went over. But maybe they'd already made the decision. I don't quite know. I'd have to rewatch that entire incident again. But
I think... Well, I didn't see him go over. Apologies if you did. But the idea that you could review that on the footage and not think that was a clear and obvious error from a referee to not give a red card, it is ridiculous. Mm. But as you say, that was not really the making of Arsenal's problems last night. And it is poor officiating, and it is a problem, but Arsenal have got plenty of problems of their own as well, based on what we saw yesterday.
Yeah, exactly. That's why I wanted to get that out of the way in this opening stage. It's a bone of contention for me that this happens, but it's not an excuse for the way that we played, for the way that the game went, for anything. But I still think it's something that's worth talking about in the, you know, for a couple of minutes, because clearly the bigger issues are what happened on the pitch and the way that we played the game and everything else. So, I mean, where do we start? Team selection?
Yeah, I guess so.
Granit Xhaka back a month ahead of schedule, starting without so much as a training game, without an under-23 game. I mean, how big of a surprise was that to you?
Quite a big surprise. I mean, he went quite big on Instagram, which did sort of make you double take. You know, he did put out that thing, "I'm back." And you wondered, would you do that if you were on the bench? I did have that thought. Nevertheless, I was still very surprised. They've been quite sketchy about how and when exactly he returned to full training. And I think that's been quite deliberate. So we don't really know how ready or how sharp he was. I mean, I presume it was a sound decision based on sort of good medical and physical grounds. But it was a big surprise. Other than that, Tierney back in was obviously, I think a lot of people expected that.
Yeah.
To be fair, a lot of people expected that in the last three games. But, you know, I think this time, I think most people thought he would play. And then Smith Rowe, we knew he had a problem. I thought he might be on the bench. He obviously missed out entirely. So with Martinelli going over to the left-hand side. And then Lacazette for Aubameyang, which, again, was talked about as a possibility. I mean, I guess with two games in 4 days, a degree of rotation was inevitable. So, yeah, the team was, with the exception of Xhaka, not hugely surprising to me. What about you?
I mean, obviously, Xhaka was a big surprise. And I think we'll talk about that in a bit more detail later, given, you know, how long he played and everything else and some of the decisions that Mikel Arteta made. Like I said, for Aubameyang, like, I wouldn't have done it, but I kind of understand why it happened. Aubameyang's not been in good form. He is the only other senior striker that we have, but I don't think it made us any better at all. There were aspects of Lacazette's performance which I found quite frustrating, in that, you know, you can look busy if you drop into central midfield, and you can look busy if you chase back and end up in the right back position a couple of times, but that's not necessarily what you want from your centre forward. You need some kind of an outlet. And I don't really understand why he put so much effort into that side of things ahead of getting into good forward positions.
I think there's another side to the coin, which is that, you know, why does a striker drop deep? And why did Lacazette and Odegaard as well at times end up coming quite so deep? And I do think that it was because Arsenal just weren't progressing at all from the back. And so there's a tendency, it's part of your job to, resist that urge. But players get drawn towards the ball, right? Mm. And the ball, especially in the first half, was in our half. I mean,
what do you put that lack of ball progression down to? I mean, a reductive way of putting it is we have the Xhaka Tierney combination on that left hand side again, which, you know, Tierney provided a very good assist.
Yeah, that was what we got our goal from. Xhaka knocked directly at Tierney. It was via Lacazette, but I don't think it was the case that Xhaka came back in and now suddenly we didn't progress the ball. And I don't think it was an entirely new problem, you know, that you can sort of pin it all on one player, one man. I think, you could also say of Lacazette, well, yeah, he's coming back because he's trying to get on the ball. But the fact that he's not up high up the pitch means we haven't got targets. It's really difficult for me to say why we just could not play through Everton, and everybody else who's played them in the last six or seven games has created chances, and we didn't do it. I mean, the first half, I was sort of turning to the journalist around me in sort of disbelief. I think was one of the worst games I've ever seen live. Like, I honestly thought it was that bad. It's not that it wasn't exciting. Like, there was a degree of spectacle about it and there was a bit of blood and thunder about Everton. But the lack of quality and confidence on show from both teams was stark and sort of distressing, and I think Everton have an excuse, really, because they've been on such a poor run of form. But from Arsenal, although we have seen some indications of those problems before, I thought this was sort of shockingly bad. The first half in particular was really dire.
Yeah,
I thought
so too. It was probably the worst performance of the season.
I think it is, because with other performances, there are mitigating factors. You know, okay, we got hammered 5-0 at Man City, but what 11 did we have out that day? Okay, we lost at Brentford.
And we had
but
10 men there, yeah.
Sure, and but we had a COVID outbreak and the transfer business wasn't done. We went to Liverpool. They're miles better than us. Everton is a team that Arsenal should have gone and been able to beat. They were a team very down, very low on confidence, whose fans were planning a walkout in the 27th minute. I mean, some of them came hoping that it would all burn down. Like, some of them came, you know, that sort of like self-destructive urge fans get where they're like, well, I hope we lose tonight, and then that'll really stick it to the manager and the owner.
Yeah.
I spoke to some Everton fans beforehand, and that was in their mindset. And so the opportunity was there for Arsenal to really go and hurt them. And if Arsenal had scored before that planned walkout in the 27th minute, that stadium, I reckon, would have been half empty, turning on the players. But we just didn't assert ourselves in any meaningful way. But
that's, yeah.
Yeah.
That's, I mean, I said that in the preview podcast and said it on the blog, that the ingredients were there for Arsenal to really take advantage of how bad Everton have been in the last couple of days. And my fear was that we were going to give them the kiss of life. And we did, because that's what we do. It's unbelievable the way that we do this. You face a team that hasn't won in 6 years and, like, somehow we just sort of gift wrap a confidence boost, a goal here, a goal there, you know, the 3 points that they need just to get themselves back up and running again. How we do this, I don't know whether it's something that we've got in our DNA or whether it's just a perception that I have, but God almighty, it was so maddening that the first half from Arsenal was as passive as it was. And you're right to say there was a little bit of blood and thunder about Everton. Some of the tackling was a bit iffy. Certainly Ben Godfrey, you know, the Tomiyasu one, that, you know, he went careering into another couple of challenges as well.
Yeah, that wasn't the only one. Quite a few from him.
But at the same time, you know, what do you expect when you go and face a team that's just been beaten in a local derby? Like, you know, they there's clearly whatever the issues that the Everton fans have with Rafa Benitez, the players are still willing to go out there and do it for him, slash the badge, the shirt, whatever you want to call it. But we could not take advantage. We didn't take it. We just played so poorly, so passively. I think we could talk about Thomas Partey at some point. You know, here's a guy who, you know, at the end of the day, was pretty tidy on the ball. I think he completed 69 of 77 passes, which is about 90% of his passes, but looks like a guy who just does not want to do anything but take the safe option because he's so short on form and so short on confidence, you know? And I think played a part in our inability to get forward, to try and get players into attacking positions. I thought Martin Odegaard was quite bright, probably the brightest Arsenal player on the night, scored a good goal.
So.
But really, that first half was just so, so bad. And I looked at two teams who weren't necessarily cancelling each other out, but Arsenal just had no way of breaking down Everton or had no ideas as to how to do that.
No, and there were no chances in the game. I mean, I think that certainly there are dots you can join. Like, what I'm about to say is not to deny that there are kind of underlying problems here that you can say, well, this has always been a problem for Arteta. But I do think that the confidence of this team has plummeted dramatically, very fast. I think that it's only a few weeks ago that we had that mantra of Arsenal start well. You know, they come out of the blocks well. We were saying first 10 minutes, 15 minutes of games, they really came out. And that's where you see a manager's instructions often is in that first 10, 15 minutes, because you see them being put into play. And I felt like we were consistently saying, you know, Arsenal will come out the blocks well. It's about whether or not they can capitalise, get that early goal. And there's an argument they did that at Old Trafford even. But at Goodison Park, that just wasn't there at all. And the ball progression was timid. It was sort of optimistic at times, like Ben White was floating a few long ball passes. I think, you know, it's interesting you bring Kieran Tierney back into the side, and as you mentioned, that sort of ball out to him almost can become a bit of a crutch. I know we scored from it, but it sometimes feels like that's it. Partey, I thought, was really poor, and we're still giving him the ball in sort of very difficult scenarios. So, you know, the plan is he draws two markers onto him. We give him the ball and say, wriggle out of there, you know, like pull something out of the hat. And Houdini, when a player is low, exactly. And we're asking him to be that kind of Santi Cazorla, get out of jail player who can beat two men and find the space and start a move. And when his confidence is high, he can do that. But I don't know. I mean, it was a strange interview I thought he gave, to be honest. I know some people were like, well, good for him. He's owning up. I'm talking about the interview where he sort of gave himself 4 out of 10 or whatever it was for his performance. But when I saw that, I was like, Christ, we've got some work to do on this guy. Like, there's not feeling yourself and there's feeling pretty shit about yourself. That was what I took from that interview. I don't know about you.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose on one hand you applaud the honesty and the openness, but at the same time it is worrying. And I think it was evident in his performance last night. You're right to say we give him these difficult passes. The only thing he did with them last night was play them straight back to whoever gave them to him.
Like, usually,
know? So when a player is out of form and when a player is low on confidence, you cannot expect him to become or you can't expect him to just sort of turn it on again. And like, one performance can change things, but I don't know.
The ball progression thing, I spent ages thinking about it. Like, what is it that is so maddening? Like, what is Arsenal's attempts to score goals like? And all it made me think about was, do you remember the board game, Mousetrap? where, like, you have to spend ages setting up this, like, assault course thing, you know, for, like, a little, for, like, a pinball to run through or something. And it feels like that, like, it has to be so intricately constructed for it to work. And when it doesn't, it's just knocking it around at the back.
Yeah, I mean, and anyone can do that. Any team of professional footballers can just play it in a horseshoe around the back. You know, play it to your central defenders, across to your fullbacks, maybe a central midfielder, keep ball, keep possession. And if you're not pressed, you can do that. I mean, we've talked about this before. We've talked about the Goldilocks aspect of Arteta's football, where if it's not just right, it's just fucking shit porridge.
And yeah, I agree with that. But also, the other thing I felt watching the game is, like, what you do on the ball is obviously important. And I actually think our defenders now are better on the ball maybe than they have ever been, or certainly have been for a few years. But I feel like there's a lot of focus on that and not enough on how we win the ball and where we win the ball. You know, all the stats, all the figures show that although we sometimes say, oh, you know, Aubameyang worked hard or Odegaard leads from the front, this team basically don't press. They basically don't press. And why?
Well,
why do we do that?
Listen, we had a couple of questions on this. You know, let me just see if I could find one here because I think it's relevant to this discussion. Okay, well, from Tokyo Gunner, who's at Tokyo underscore Gunner on Twitter, says, why do Arsenal have no intensity in a game when we play once a week? And I know the schedule is amped up a little bit, but we had discussions about this when we talked about not being in Europe, when we talked about, are there benefits to this? And, you know, are we better out of Europe for one season because we can really go for it in the Premier League? Arteta's got more time on the training ground. The players won't be fatigued. Like, you're right. We never win the ball high up the pitch, or very rarely win the ball high up the pitch. What we wait and do is turn it over as they get towards our final third, or certainly in our half, and we look for them to make a mistake, or we look to, you know, break out from the back, having won the ball or won a second ball close to our own area, but we do not make any concerted effort to win the ball high up the pitch. And look, I'm not saying we should be Liverpool or anything like that, but look at how many goals they score when they do that. Look at how they hurt teams when they win the ball in areas where you don't have to get 60, 70 yards up the pitch to then have an attempt on goal.
Exactly. And I think, you know, there's been a lot of debate this week. I wasn't on a podcast after the United game, but about what is Arteta's instruction and what is not. But I do think that this clearly is deliberate, that Arsenal don't press high. They sit in deep, they engage later, and they invite teams on, and then they look to kind of break through those gaps when they do win it. But I have serious concerns about that. I just feel that when you're talking about goals, you need to think of the ways, how can we score? How can we create chances in the ways that don't depend on technical perfection from our players?
Yeah.
And pressing and, you know, not permitting the opposition time on the ball is one of the very obvious ways in which you can do that. And as you say, if you've got a squad who aren't playing as many minutes as your immediate rivals, you know, people say when Liverpool went out of the Champions League, you know, didn't have European football, they got back in the top four. And it's like, well, yeah, because look how they played. Like, because Klopp's got that intense running style. And that squad was able to sustain that better across a season than they otherwise can. And I think we've missed a trick by not doing that. You know, Ralph Rangnick came into United and, you know, they produced a high intensity performance in his first game. And Cristiano Ronaldo, who I think had been the least intense forward in terms of his work rate in the Premier League, was charging all over the place, and the numbers backed it up. And it's very simply done. I mean, he's got a training exercise, and I'm sure Arteta has similar, but we're not seeing the benefits of it, where, you know, famously, he plays like a small-sided game. And when you've got the ball, the opposition have got 8 seconds to win it back. And if they don't, they lose a point. And then when they get it, they've got to score within 10 seconds. And if they don't, they lose a point. And it's all focused on those transition moments. But when you listen to Mikel Arteta, he talks about this team being weak in transition. He says, when the game goes into transition, that's where we struggle. I don't know if I think that's working for us. And the other area, just on this kind of what more can we do other than play very intricate, very beautifully crafted passes through to create a goal, I think second balls, you know, the amount of times Aaron Ramsdale's going long and, okay, Aubameyang doesn't win it or Lacazette doesn't win it. But the amount of times we don't get to the next ball is really concerning. Like, your centre forward doesn't have to win it because the centre half is only going to knock it back into the midfield. That's where you can get on it. That's where you can suddenly be on the front foot again. But we just don't do that often enough and things end up coming right back at us. And these feel like fixable, trainable things. And that's the frustration, really. You know, I think we're sort of becoming accustomed to, well, the way you score, of course, is you win it on the edge of your own box. And then you play, you know, three or four perfectly weighted passes. And that's how you get into the penalty area. And that's not how, you know, most teams in this league are playing, with good reason.
No, I mean, and you talk about these things being trainable and coachable, and of course they are, but only if that's what the coach or the manager wants to do, or that's the way that he wants his team to operate. Yeah. And if here we are 2 years down the line, nearly, with Mikel Arteta, that's not something that he focuses on, then, you know, is that something he's going to do?
I'm reminded, I sort of retracted it a bit, but I remember after the Crystal Palace game, you know, I said that thing about, I feel like Arteta is so focused on what happens in our half. Like, he's, you know, I feel like hours on the training ground are spent on, what do we do when Ramsdale's got the ball? You know, what do we do when Ben White's got the ball? How do we exit from there? And even like in terms of the transfer resource, it's all gone in that part of the pitch, really.
Yeah.
It's all gone in, like, our own third of the pitch. And I do just feel like the team, we get to the halfway line, and sometimes it feels like we just have a bit of a nosebleed.
Yeah. Yeah.
And this is the thing, like, obviously we're not scoring enough goals. We all know that. And listen, by the way, this is all very negative for me. I appreciate that. And there is a kind of, you know, there is a context which I can apply later, which is not quite so doomy. But I think, you know, we end up looking at our defence and we're saying, are they as good as we thought? You know, we don't, you know, we're asking questions of every aspect of the team. I think that the problem is when you don't exert a consistent attacking threat, you let an opposition into the game. Like Everton were nowhere until they realised, oh, these guys aren't that dangerous. Like, we can push on. We can, you know, chuck a ball into Richarlison and see what happens. Because, you know, when you are consistently threatening, it pins teams back, it forces teams back, it tires them out. If you can keep the ball in their half, mentally and physically, it's draining for the opposition.
But we just
don't do that.
I absolutely agree with that. Absolutely agree that is one of our, you know, people think about attacking football or dominating areas of the pitch as, well, we don't score enough goals, and clearly we don't, and we need to do more. And I don't know really if that's possible, to be honest, under this coach and with this system, this manager rather. But you're right that being able to build attacks, to win second balls, to play the game higher up the pitch, to win the ball higher up the pitch, it also makes you more defensively secure. Opposition can't score when you've got the ball in their half. I mean, Everton scored twice last night, but also could easily have scored four. The two Richarlison offsides were so marginal, like by the letter of the law.
We'd be fuming.
Yeah, I think we probably would. You know, or at least be looking at it as, well, you know, the margin was so tight. We can take some positivity from it. I mean, the warning sign was there at the end of the first half. Not for the first time in recent weeks, we've been suspect at a set piece. You know, we conceded at Liverpool. The opening goal was a set piece. We've looked a little bit shaky.
Yeah, like towards the end of a first half. I mean, I do think there's a bit of a problem, sort of last 5 minutes of a half, first 5 minutes of a half. Those periods are so crucial. That's when you really want the concentration to be there. In fairness to the team, they responded to that moment quite well. Yeah. I think those VAR moments are strange kind of momentum swings in games, and Arsenal kind of capitalised on that one.
Well, they did. It was a lovely goal, lovely finish from Martin Odegaard, good cross from Kieran Tierney. You've just been led off the hook by VAR. You go in 1-0 at halftime. I think it's an opportunity for the manager to sort of, okay, put things right. And this, I think, is another issue that is increasingly apparent with Mikel Arteta, is his ability to change games and change the momentum of games and change the way that we play within the games, even from one half to the next. Sometimes, you know, I remember talking about how we're a second half team. We throw away first halves and we respond. We haven't really been able to do that a great deal, but I thought this was one where we go in at halftime and Arteta says, look, that was shit. That was terrible, but we're ahead. Let's do better this half. Let's create some kind of siege mentality because of what happened to Tomiyasu. That's a thing where, you know, it's a classic. I don't think anyone could have posted the picture up on the wall or anything like that. But, you know, who's got an
iPad?
They've
all got phones.
They've all got iPads. Get some fucking one of those little coaches to go around with his iPad and go, look at this. You know, create some kind of us against them. But the second half was more of the same. They had another goal disallowed close to the hour mark. Again, it's just so, so marginal. But, you know, on both occasions, and I think we probably overlook this, is that on both of those disallowed Richarlison goals, the Arsenal defending was terrible. It was really bad. You know, from the set piece.
You tell me, because I've not had time to study it in depth.
Well, the other one was a set piece, and I think if I remember, for the second goal, or for the second disallowed goal, I think Ben White should have stepped up to engage. I think it was Doucouré. Instead, he stepped backwards, let him make a pass, and you know, from there, the goal, if you like, was scored, but he was offside marginally, like a hair's breadth offside. You know, so we were lucky in that sense. And then I think we get to another real issue, which is substitutions.
Yeah, we'll get on to that. I just want to say I did think that Arsenal, I did think they started the second half better than they had the first. I thought they were a little bit improved in that first 10 minutes, but it just didn't sustain.
Yeah, there was a great ball from Kieran Tierney, if I remember, straight across the penalty box.
Yeah,
there was nobody there.
There were a couple of crosses. There was one for Tomiyasu as well, where it was a good area.
There was a free kick from Martin Odegaard where he found Gabriel, who tried to head it back across.
That was a good chance, I think.
I think so too. I mean, I don't know if he should have gone for goal or should have been a bit more accurate with the way he headed it back across.
One or the other. There was an initial response, but then, you know, when Everton raised their intensity, we didn't match it. And to come on to the substitutions, that was a curious evening of substitutions.
It really, really was. So let's deal with them. Kieran Tierney coming off for Nuno Tavares. Maybe it was pre-planned. It felt a little bit pre-planned, 60 minutes, 65 minutes, something like that. But I don't really understand it. This is a guy, he hasn't played a lot in the last few weeks, but he's also super fresh. He's not fatigued. He's not tired. You know, he's training every day. Why are we making an unnecessary substitution at that point? And, you know, I think you made a really good point on your on the whistle video about Tierney, which is that even though Tavares has been in the team for the last few weeks, we have had opportunities and moments where we could give Tierney 20 minutes here, 20 minutes there, if that's what's necessary to get him to a point where he can play 90 minutes. I don't necessarily think that it is. I think Tierney should be able to come into this team and play 90 minutes at Everton, unless there's some injury we don't know anything about. But I thought that was a good point, that there was an opportunity over the last few weeks to give Tierney some minutes, to make him more match fit, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
And I think that was an unnecessary change, which then hampered us later on.
I agree. I mean, I think, yeah, if we wanted to keep Tierney sharp across this period, we've had plenty of opportunities to do it. And I think if you start a game, if you know he's not going to last 90 minutes, and you start a game with Kieran Tierney coming back from injury, Granit Xhaka, who hasn't played a minute in months, and Alexandre Lacazette, who you know can't do 90 minutes,
yeah,
then you've made your substitution decisions already. So you're in a position of complete inflexibility. And it's almost like he forgot he only had three subs. He thought it was back in five subs time. I don't think you can pick those three players knowing they're not going to make the 90 minutes, because what happens if someone else gets an injury?
Yeah,
what happens
exactly
if you need a goal? Or yeah, as happened, you know, Martinelli had to come off. That was very, very, very strange, I think.
Yeah, because we made that change and then... What, 5 minutes later? 5 minutes later, Martinelli had to go off. And
yeah.
I was looking at that going, on the hour mark, I think I said it on the live blog, around the hour mark, that we need to get Lacazette and Xhaka off because they both looked knackered. Like, yeah. And I understand it in Xhaka's case because he hasn't played for 2.5 months and he hasn't had training games and he hasn't had a run out in the under-23s. And there is a difference between just training and match fitness, et cetera, et cetera. So he hasn't played at Premier League level for that length of time. So I understand it when it comes to Xhaka. But that should surely have been part of the thinking, is that, like, if we're bringing this guy back to start a game after this much time out, chances are we're going to need to replace him at 60, 70 minutes, there or thereabouts.
Of course, Andrew. I mean, you know, he played the full 90 minutes. When have you ever seen a player come back into the starting lineup, an outfield player, after an absence of that long and an injury of that sort of severity, and play the full 90 minutes? I honestly can barely remember it happening.
Yeah, same.
It's a complete given that he shouldn't have had the full 90 minutes. And yeah, as for Tierney, like, as I said, we had opportunities in league games. There've been under 23 games if we were desperate to get in minutes. I don't get it. And the irony, of course, being that Martinelli then goes down injured. You've already put Tavares on at left back. Probably Tavares for Martinelli would have been quite a good sub at that point in the game. You know, I think that would have been relatively useful, but yeah, the opportunity was gone. And then Arteta, in a move which is the subject of much discussion today, went for Eddie Nketiah.
Look, this is not a criticism of Eddie Nketiah, who missed a really good chance, and he's a penalty box poacher, and that's what he's in the team for, and that's where he is at his best. He missed a big chance.
Can I say something very controversial? I thought he was probably Arsenal's best attacker on the day.
Look, he got into a good position. He created a good chance for Aubameyang.
Created some good chances, but that doesn't preclude what you're about to say.
This is a mental, crazy substitution. Can I just... put this in a little bit of context. Just in terms of what the decision is from the manager. Eddie Nketiah, in the first, I think, 10 Premier League games, did not make the squad. He was on the bench for the Watford game, not in the squad for the Liverpool game, on the bench for the Newcastle game. He gets his first minutes of the season against Manchester United, 11 minutes of Premier League football. And in this game, in the context of this performance, in a game where I think we needed a second goal, to be honest, he puts him on at left wing. I can't get my head around it, other than it being Mikel Arteta sending a message to some of his other players, whether it's Pepe, whether it's Aubameyang, like, here we are. I mean, Aubameyang I don't necessarily like him on the left, but if it's not Pepe, that's the obvious selection. If you're not replacing Lacazette, you know what I mean?
Of course, yeah.
It felt like this is Arteta sending a message using an in-game situation, not for the best use of the team, if you like, but for a kind of man management type thing. And look, it's not Nketiah's fault that we conceded the goals that we did. He should have scored the chance that he scored to make it 2-1. But in the overall context of this game and the overall context of this season and how much Nketiah has been involved, it makes no sense to make that change. It's baffling.
So here's what I think. I think that I've got a few theories about that, the substitution, which I'll come on to. If he really thought that Nketiah was the best option, then I don't have a problem with that per se. My issue is more what does that say about what has become of Aubameyang and Pepe? And to what extent are those players being mismanaged? Do you see what I mean? Like, if it's at the point where Arteta genuinely thinks, for whatever reason, I need to choose Nketiah out of these three guys, with respect to Eddie, then something has gone wrong, right? I think the theory that it was about making a point has some grounds to it. It was a very strange post-match press conference. I don't know if this was clear, but basically none of the journalists could hear a word Mikel was saying. So they were asking him questions and he was answering back. But it was just, we would just see his mouth moving and it was complete silence. Perhaps like it is in the dressing room for the players, it feels like at times. So the questions were kind of like, if it's felt like the questions were a little bit odd, it's because they weren't able to sort of be sequential in any way, because no one had any clue what he had responded to what they'd said.
Right.
But he was asked about
Pepe.
Eddie and Pepe a couple of times. Yeah. And what he said about Eddie was, I brought him on because he shows in training every day what he produced here this evening. And we can presume by that he means the creating the chances for people, not the missing header from 1 yard out. And that to me suggests that he's trying to send a message. Like, if he comes out and says, I brought Nketiah on because of the commitment and application and the performances he produces in training, then the implicit thing is, and if I didn't bring somebody on, it's because I'm not happy with what they're doing in that.
Yeah, but I think
it's a leap, but I think that.
I mean,
has
it might well be
credibility.
It might well be. I mean, the if he's seeing that from Eddie in training every day, has he only just started doing it? Because he hasn't been in the squad for fucking the whole season, basically. And look, the other thing we didn't mention about Eddie is that he's turned down a new contract, and he's going to leave. He's going to leave the club. Might even be in January if we can sell him. But, you know, what Arteta, I just don't get it. I don't get it. It felt political is not quite the right word.
Well, this is my other pet theory, because I don't quite buy into the, you know, he did it so we can get an extra 500,000 for Eddie in January.
No.
I don't really think that's a thing. Like, when you're chasing a game, that you would forgo, you know, bringing on a better player because you're thinking about the transfer market. But I do wonder if, I'm not sure about this, but I texted you this earlier. I remember the Brentford game when Arsenal were losing and Arteta took off Callum Chambers, I think it was, who was playing at right back, and brought on Nuno Tavares as his right back.
Yeah.
And I think he had Cedric on the bench, and it maybe even had Bellerin still. I can't remember, but he definitely had another right back on the bench. Maitland-Niles, maybe it was.
Yeah.
And to me, that was a very clear sort of signal of, like, I'm not happy with what I've got. And the reason I bring that up is because it's precedent. And I do wonder if bringing Eddie on to play left wing was maybe a signal of like, I'm not happy with what I've got here.
Oh, yeah, but like, there are ways you can do that without it impacting the team in the way that it did, you know?
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, like, I don't think... The weird thing is, I don't think the Eddie substitution was a disaster. Like, I don't think it made us worse. I think he actually played pretty well, with the exception of the miss. I just think I worry much more about what it means for Aubameyang and what it means for Pepe.
Sure. I mean, look, there's very, very clearly an issue with Pepe right now, and he's stony-faced on the bench. And when you're being overlooked for a want-away 20-year-old, 21-year-old striker who's playing out of position, there's something very serious
going on.
Yeah, there's something going on. And like, you know, will he be the next victim, maybe is the wrong word, but like, I think Tim Stillman said this on Twitter today in reply to somebody, I can't remember who it was, but I laughed when I saw it, but he was going, has there ever been a time under Mikel Arteta when there hasn't been at least the perception that he's beefing or whatever you want to call it with a player at some point in his Arsenal managerial career, coaching career. It's a consistent theme. Now, maybe we're reading too much into it. Maybe he's just thinking, well, Pepe hasn't been playing very well. I don't want, you know, but like, this is our record signing who hasn't got on the pitch bar 5 minutes of action in the last five or six games. And there are, you know, even if you have reservations about him as a footballer, which I think many people do, you know, there's a good case to be made that in some of these games, he could have been useful. You know?
Yeah, I think so. I mean let's not forget, he has been a bit crap as well.
Yeah, he has. I'm not saying that, but he's still... Like, this is... We come back to our goal-scoring issue. Pepe, for all his flaws, is somebody who gets involved in goals.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. And I just think this is a manager who is going, well, I don't know what else to do. I'll try this and just see if it's any good. You know,
maybe. I think it's too weird for it to be that. A gambler puts on Aubameyang. Do you know what I mean?
Because they
play the odds. Here's what I think about the kind of fallout with players or the you know, the sort of tension that exists with certain players. I don't mind non-negotiables. Like, I like non-negotiables. I think it's good to have standards. It's good to have authority. And it's good when you make a very clear decision about if somebody's on board or not on board. So in that respect, I don't have like a massive issue with the way Arteta handled, say, Matteo Guendouzi, because it was like something happened. There was an incident. He had a certain number of warnings. The line was drawn. He never got another look in, right? I'm okay with that if it's clear. What is a problem is situations like Aubameyang, like Pepe, where are these there are these contradictory mixed messages, like Maitland-Niles, where they get a few games, they're part of the group, everything seems positive. Then their form drops, something happens, I don't know, maybe it's something we don't see, and then they're out again. And in a few weeks' time, they'll be back in.
And it'll be someone else's turn to be on the, you know, on the out...
On the naughty step, yeah, I don't know. But for me, it's a much bigger problem, the ones where you don't make your mind up.
Yeah.
If you make your mind up that you don't want Pepe, and you sell him last summer... or get rid of him, that is fine with me. But don't do this thing of keeping him and not being decisive.
Yeah, look, it is a bit more complicated in the sense that...
It's not easy to do this.
There are other aspects to transfers and moving players on and all of those kind of things. But I think you're right. It's the consistency of the decision making. And certainly from our side of things, our perception of it is that there isn't that. There isn't the consistency. That it sort of vacillates between one thing and another. Or a guy is good one week. He's important. We love him. He's so great. I kept Sambi in the team for Newcastle after his difficult period at Old Trafford or at Anfield because I really believe in him and knew Nuno and blah, blah, and all of a sudden Sambi can't get a game. You know, hasn't played in the last couple of games. You know, and I wonder as well, the Aubameyang thing is a problem. Clearly, the goal scoring is a problem. The form is a problem. Has he not just made it bigger by doing what he did in last night's game? By emasculating is the wrong word, but to make the changes that he did, to throw Aubameyang on in the 85th minute, and look, he missed a chance as well. So I'm not here, I'm not like going to bat for Aubameyang, but at the end of the day, he's our highest paid player, he's our captain, he's our striker, he's still the best striker we have at the club, which says something about the striking issues that we have. And we know that he is quite an emotional guy, a bit of a sensitive guy, that what happened last night, I don't think it's going to do anything for Aubameyang's confidence or how he currently feels about, you know, what's going on. And maybe that's...
I think it might do something bad.
Yeah, that's what I mean. What I mean.
And, you know, happy Aubameyang, smiling, joking, laughing, Instagram stories with Lacazette Aubameyang is great. You really want him around. Unhappy Aubameyang? No, thank you. No, thank you. I mean, you know, when the smile drops... you lose the player.
Yeah,
I really think that in his case. He's very emotional in how he plays. And part of me thinks, when did we start to lose Aubameyang? Like, was it when Lacazette came out of the team? You know, they've got this weird, you know, they're very tight, aren't they? And sometimes I wonder, I don't know, man. I don't know.
Yeah.
I think you're right to say, you know, it's not as easy as making a decision on Aubameyang or Pepe. You know, there's other factors at play there. It will always be on Arteta's record that he was a big part of giving Aubameyang the contract that he did, you know. Even if I think at the time, generally more people were in favour of that than against it. But yeah, it's and there is this sense that we're kind of waiting out this generation of attackers that kind of they need to go. But you know, season's a long time to wait, as I wrote today, and you've got to make do with what you've got.
Well, that's exactly it. You can want something else, but you can't scupper what you have until you get it. You know what I mean? You can't just say, this isn't perfect for me, therefore I'm going to behave or make decisions which don't benefit the player, the team, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm not saying he's deliberately sabotaging himself, but I don't think he handles situations as well as he could. And this is another one. You know, we're a team that can't score goals, and the three main goal scorers, Aubameyang, Lacazette, certainly in terms of his status as a senior striker, and Pepe... Like, all of them have massive question marks over them right now. And how are we supposed to score goals in the meantime? You know?
Of course, yeah. And listen, this is not to absolve those players of individual responsibility.
No.
But they're certainly, I think they're better than what we're getting from them. And I think, you know, that point about sort of Goldilocks football, sometimes it feels a bit like Goldilocks team building too. You know, Arteta talks about that idea of specificity. You know, I've got to have this exact centre-back, and I've got to have this exact type of goalkeeper, and now I've got to have this exact type of centre-forward. And the problem is that in the interim, while you're sort of waiting for those pieces to fall into place, you know, it doesn't... It's not that it doesn't work, but it feels like there's sort of not a commitment to making the best of what we've got in some ways. I don't know if that makes any sense.
It does. I mean, and he often says this, that the job is to get the best out of the players that we have. You know, he was asked about the transfer window in January, and he said the focus is getting, you know, the most out of the players that we have. But I worry that, you know, that's clearly not happening, because we know that some of these players are capable of more than we're seeing from them. And that's not just the goal scorers.
Should we touch on the goals that we conceded?
Yeah, I think we should. I think we should. Look, coming back to the substitutions, this is not all on Nuno, and I'm not here to kill him or anything like that, but this is the third successive away game where he's been found wanting when it comes to an Arsenal goal. I think there was a bit of a mix-up between himself and Thomas Partey from a throw-in, and
it was shoddy.
It was shoddy play from both of them, a little bit reminiscent of the mix-up between himself and Smith Rowe for the second United goal. To his credit, he tracks Richarlison into the box, but then completely switches off. He's ball-watching as the shot came back off the post. Richarlison is there to head home, and like, I mean, I begrudge him the goal. Of course I do, but, you know.
Yeah, I mean, listen, they got a bit lucky with the ball rebounding exactly to him, but they hadn't had much luck prior to then.
Exactly.
Certainly with the VAR calls.
And we didn't react. We didn't react. You know, Nuno wasn't aware. He didn't.
No.
He switched off.
Ramsdale's on the floor. Yeah. He actually makes a save on the first shot. Mm. By the F and the second one. I mean, he takes the header well, but it was the least that Everton deserved.
I think so. I think so. The second one, this comes back to Granit Xhaka, who picked up a booking around the 70-minute mark. I can't remember. Certainly around the time he should have been taken off had we not fucked up our substitutes.
Yeah, it was a classic Xhaka booking. The game had a lot of sort of trademark Granit Xhaka moments, good and bad, and that booking was absolutely one.
Absolutely. So when Gomez picks up the ball in central midfield, what Granit Xhaka, without a yellow card, or a central midfielder without a yellow card, should do is just make the foul. Yeah. Haul him back, grab his shirt.
He should have done it anyway, probably. Do you know? Like, it was...
Yeah. Maybe he should have. I mean, then we'd be, you know, there'd be another big, huge discussion about a Xhaka red card. But
he can handle that.
Because he wouldn't give a fuck one way or the other. Yeah. He just genuinely wouldn't give a fuck. So I do think the yellow card was on his mind, though. And I do think the fact that it was his first game back, I think, 10 games in,
he makes that
foul. But on his first game back, he's reading the headlines in his head going, Xhaka returns, gets sent off on his first game back. I mean, I wouldn't have had any huge objection to it either because, get it out of your system and come back.
Also, he shouldn't have been out there.
That's exactly the point. He should not have been on the pitch at that point. Comes back to Arteta, defending, not brilliant. Tomiyasu had two men to deal with. I'm not sure Ben White got close enough, but it's a brilliant strike from Damari Gray. The keeper had absolutely no chance, but the ball should never have got that far up the pitch. And if we'd managed our game better, if we'd managed the substitutions better, if we had a central midfielder on there who would have made that foul, then, you know, we come away with a draw point. We're not happy with that because it's a game we should win. But it's fucking far better than losing the way we lost.
Exactly. And I think in the cold light of day, it's easy to say this, but when Everton get that equaliser, you're away from home, last 10 minutes, there's some tired legs in the Arsenal team, and that was evident. Don't lose. Don't lose.
Mm.
Like, I know that we felt it was a game we should win, and we felt we could score in the game, and we had chances. You know, you think of Nketiah, you think of Aubameyang as well, really late on. We felt that we still had a threat in the game. But when you go to 1-1, don't lose.
Yeah, it's like the United
game.
Don't lose. And
it changes everything. The narrative, the confidence of the players. You're able to come away from it and be like, whew, that was a lucky escape. We were shit. We got a point. And then we probably say that thing that we've said a couple of other times this season. Oh, last season we would have lost that. And somebody, somewhere, should have been hammering that home, that message. Don't lose. Don't get swept up in the emotion of, we've just lost to United, we need to win 3 points. Because that defeat is much, much, much more damaging than the draw. We would have still been sat here raking over a really poor performance, asking questions about the attacking play, all those things. But at the end of the podcast, we would have gone, well, we got a point, on to the next one.
Mm.
Now, it's an inquest.
Well, I tell you what, though, I think what makes that defeat particularly disappointing, and this week particularly disappointing, is that I think we were looking at these two games as a way of measuring, you know, has the progress that we think we've made, is it enough? Is it sufficient? And, you know, there's a three-team title race, and then there's the rest. There's United, there's Tottenham, there's West Ham, and there's us. And this was a way of measuring where we are in that particular setup. And I think what makes this feel, certainly for me anyway, especially damaging and especially disheartening is that when it came time to stand up and be counted, we were stupid, we were daft, we didn't manage games as well as we should have on the pitch, the manager didn't manage games as well as he should have from the sideline, and those things contributed to us getting nothing from two games that maybe we should have only got 2 points from. Maybe it's only 2 points. Mm-hmm. But 2 points in this Premier League table right now, where does that put us? I mean, it puts us on 25. We'd be in fifth place. Only 2 points off the top four. And we're still, you know, 4 points away from the top four. But these two games, yeah, they've really, really disappointed me. And they've raised very, very big questions about whether or not the progress that we had hoped we'd seen and the green shoots that we were looking at are sufficient for us to really improve on where we finished last season.
Well, I think they will be very damaging. And my fear is that they've really hurt the confidence of the group. Like, I actually think if we sat down and watched the Old Trafford game again, there would be things that we would be encouraged by. I don't think it was an unmitigated disaster. And I think that's why losing it was so painful, because having watched the game, I think we all had a sense of we should have taken something from that.
I think Jim from East Lower wrote a blog about this, one of his occasional blogs, and his headline was, "Frustration is better than resignation." Which I think is a great point, because, like, if you just go to Old Trafford and get beaten, you expect to get beaten. It's like, well, but, like, being frustrated that we didn't take something from the game suggests that, you know, we're capable of better. And I think we were capable of taking something from that game. It's our ability to contrive the worst possible outcome for ourselves when there's a bit of spotlight, when there's a bit of pressure, when there's a chance to make a statement. The statement is, we're not learning.
Yeah, I think the Everton performance was a consequence of the players losing. You know, I think they fed into one another, and I think the Everton performance was much worse than the Old Trafford one.
I really believe
that, and that worries me because it's a young group. I know people are bored of me saying that. For the most part, it is a young group. It's a young team on average, and as Arsene Wenger told us a million times, building that confidence takes a long time. You go up via the stairs, you come down via the elevator.
Yeah.
And I think we watched Arsenal over 10 games, whatever it was, on the route into Anfield, climbing those stairs. And I think we may have seen against Everton that they've just crashed down back to the ground floor.
Mm.
And that is going to be really tricky, to see like how they respond to this. You know, I think it's going to be very interesting indeed. Because actually, like, you know, the fixtures, Southampton at the weekend, again, that's pretty kind. You know, much like, was it Watford immediately?
Newcastle
after Liverpool. And then West Ham in about a week's time. It was obviously daunting, but it was also an absolutely enormous opportunity for a team to kind of restake their claim in this push for European places. So, but how do you change it? How do you lift them? I mean, I know they were gutted last night, and people won't have much sympathy because they played poorly, but they were gutted. And losing a game in those circumstances late on like that is a gut-wrenching thing. and it's different to we were outclassed by a better team.
Mm.
It's Mikel Arteta's job, I guess. Mm. You know,
it feels a bit like after the opening three games of the season, this scenario that we find ourselves in that sense, in that we have put ourselves with our backs to the wall.
Mikel Arteta had the best 15 days of his managerial life after that. He needs to have a pretty good 3 days now before Southampton.
Yeah.
Like, it's a job and a half. Mm. And the thing is, you know, it is tricky. Our senior players aren't performing well enough, and we all know that. And obviously the manager is responsible for all the players' performance. But we have also made this commitment to youth in other areas. And, you know, we talk about Nuno making three mistakes in three games. If you play young defenders, they're going to make mistakes. Mm. If you play young attackers, I think they're not going to be as productive as players in their prime. To a certain extent, we have, you know, shackled ourselves to that. So we have to accept that with that comes risk, comes undulation. Arteta's had a real knack, I think, in his Arsenal reign of when things look really bad, he's able to turn it round for a period of time.
Mm.
And some would say that rival fans like that aspect because, you know, it kind of keeps him in the job. He individually, personally, needs one of those moments again now.
Yeah, for sure. He needs a very solid 3 weeks between now and the end of the year.
Yeah, and the Man City game. I mean, so it's Southampton at home, West Ham at home, Leeds away, Norwich away, Wolves at home. That is pretty generous. And the weird thing about this league is that even though we're not playing especially well, you know, if we beat all those, if we were to win those games, the table would look pretty healthy. But it's a big if.
It is a very big if, you know, and that's why this week has made that if particularly large. Bold font if, if you like. Right, look.
Definitely.
Let's take a short break here and we'll fly through some questions in part two because time is a little bit tight today, but we'll get through as many questions as we can. I think we've covered a lot of the issues around that game and the team overall, but we'll get into some specifics and questions in part two right after this.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome back to the Arsecast Extra. This is part two of the show where we answer questions that you send to us on Twitter at Gunnarblog and at Arseblog, also on the Arseblog Discord chat server, which you get access to if you are an Arseblog member on Patreon. Do you want to start? Will I start?
I want you to start.
Okay, fair enough.
Decisive.
Fair enough. Jez Box on the Twitter says,
yes.
Partey is now a real problem. Is there any obvious solution?
He's in a funk, isn't he?
Mm.
I don't believe he's not a talented player. Do I believe we may at times overestimate his ability? I'm beginning to. But I still think he's better than... I still think he's a very gifted player. I think clearly his confidence is low. I think Xhaka coming back will be a good thing for him. Didn't look at it last night particularly, but I do think it will. What do you do? I mean, I guess the question is, do you take him out of the team? And I guess I'm not quite sold enough on our other midfield options to be like, yeah, definitely. I think I'm still in the camp of like, desperately hope he finds form. What about you?
I'm sort of in that one as well. Like, I know what people say about, you know, leaving players out and let them sit out a couple of games. I'm not sure how well that works with players of, you know, who are 28, 29, that kind of age. Like, I think if you're a young player and you're out of form and you get dropped, you kind of compartmentalize that a bit easier. Hmm. But when you're a senior player, and look, at least he's aware of it. He knows himself, and that's a good thing. He's acknowledged it. I don't know. I don't know what the answer to this one is, whether you just play him and let him come back into form. There were a couple of passes in the second half last night which weren't bad.
But yeah, he's in that place at the moment shooting, where... oh, man, that shot. He's in that place where... we're seeing his... I think we are... Don't get me wrong, he's not being good. But like at Old Trafford, say, he had some very eye-catching bad moments in the first half, and that sort of dominates discourse a little bit. He actually was all right in the second half. And I think that because we're worried about him, every miscontrol, every misplaced pass, we're like... And that sort of, you know, it's sort of spiraling. Perception of him is spiraling right now. I think you stick with him, but I do think this is a general point. It's not just aimed at Thomas Partey. It is time for our senior players to step up. And this is not to absolve the manager of responsibility in any way, but these leaders in the squad, as they're so often called and referred to, the likes of Partey, Xhaka, Lacazette, Aubameyang. I think you've got to count someone like Tierney among that, even though he's not particularly old.
Mm.
We need them desperately now. And I had a really interesting conversation with a former Premier League player after the Man United game. And I was sort of saying to him, you know, it feels like the team just don't follow... Either the team don't follow the manager's instructions or, you know, I was talking about the sitting off thing. What's happening there? Why are they doing that? If Arteta's on the sidelines waving them up and that's not what he wants, why is that happening? And he was like, listen, you can have whatever manager you want. The game starts and it's people on the pitch making those decisions. And he said, I remember when I was a young defender, I'd have an experienced player next to me and they would tell me, now's the moment, the next 10 minutes, stay in the game.
Mm.
We just need to stay in the game. This 10 minutes, push up, we're on them. And it just feels like Arsenal, and I know it's a boring trope that's been trotted out time after time, but in these two games, we have lacked leadership and we need to find it from somewhere, I think. Because, you know, Arteta is responsible, but also... you need those coaches on the pitch too to micromanage those situations, because once you're out there, there's huge onus on the players there.
I mean, that what you've just said scares the shit out of me. Because... Why? I think you spoke a couple of weeks ago about Thomas Partey not necessarily being that kind of guy. Aubameyang, as we know, is not really your archetypal leader. Lacazette puts himself about a bit, wins a few free kicks. I think he's a good guy around the training ground, according to the young players, etc., etc. But, you know, again, not really that kind of guy. Xhaka maybe is the only one that you could point to And Xhaka's version or flavor of leadership, you know, is questionable. We've seen that down the years. That, like, he is clearly a big personality. And we have all this stuff about, like, well, he got the keys of the house when he was 6 months old, but he probably burned it down when he was a year.
Yeah, there's a lot of ego in his form of leadership.
And yes.
That's not uniformly a negative thing, but it's a very specific type of thing, yeah. And it's like, and maybe it's wrong of me to say it's all on the senior players, but I just feel like they are the group who we need more of that from. And frankly, whose experience in these situations should be valuable. You know?
I think so. But then there's also part of me that, again, without wanting to make any excuses for any of the players, or, you know, we know that some of them aren't playing as well as they can. I just wonder, are they in some way, or what's happening to them is in some way because of just the collective, that the overall issues that the team has are beyond their capabilities as players. Like, I'm not saying they can't do better, but is it putting too much on them to say, you know, what was Arteta's quote over the weekend? The leaders have, or senior players have to lead and the young players have to follow. Mm. Well, that's the opposite of what's been happening. Mm. You know, when it comes to productive end product and all that kind of stuff, it's the young players. It was Saka last season who was carrying the team at times. It's Odegaard, who's 22, who scored in the last couple of games. It's Smith Rowe, who's been, you know, the oil in the engine and who has scored goals in the last few weeks for us. So I get what he's saying about senior players doing more, but I don't know. I don't think that's necessarily the solution. I'm not saying it won't make us better, but I don't know that Aubameyang and Partey playing better than they have fixes this team to the extent that we want it to be fixed, if that makes sense.
Maybe not, but I think it makes us a darn sight better.
I agree. But, I mean, look, can I follow up on that? Because here's a question from the Discord as well, from Gunnar MCC, who says, I think I know the answer. But is it the strikers on the pitch or is it the system? Like, would Richarlison have scored for us tonight?
I don't know. He looked good, I thought, by the way.
I think he's a good player, yeah.
You know, there's a lot of reports around about Dominic Calvert-Lewin at Everton, and he is someone Arsenal interested in. But someone said to me Everton might be more minded to sell Richarlison, and I was thinking, wow, he looks pretty handy, actually, and he can play like a few different positions. Anyway, well, we spoke about this, about not progressing the ball. I mean, you know, it's a bit of both, isn't it?
Mm.
Lacazette is just not getting shots off anymore.
No.
And I think when you play other strikers in that role, Aubameyang, even on our bad days, he at least gets a couple of shots in. So I think clearly that's a bit of individual responsibility there. But obviously the system could do more as well. You know, we're just... This isn't really an answer to the question, but I just want to say it. So is that all right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think the answer is a bit of both on the question. I've noticed this thing that's happening around Arsenal at the moment where, like, there are a lot of these sort of big analytics reads being like, what are Arsenal? Do you know what I mean? Like, sort of, what are Arsenal? Are they good? Are they not good?
Yeah,
sure. It's you know, it's in-depth stuff. And some of it's really good. James Benge wrote a good thing. And there was another thing last night that I retweeted. Who was it by? I might as well give it a shout out. Grace Robertson. And it's sort of looking at the, you know, underlying numbers for Arsenal. But for me, the fact that those pieces need to be written tells its own story. You know, the fact that everyone's looking at this team and going, sorry, what's going on? Like, can we find some numbers that give us a definitive conclusion about this team? And the conclusion in those pieces is always not really. Like, we don't really know. Are they good? Are they bad? What are they good at? They're not especially good at defending. They're not especially good at attacking. And I'm not saying this to slam them. I'm just saying that's where Arsenal are. And the mental thing is, like, I think they'll beat Southampton. And I wouldn't be surprised if they beat West Ham and then lose to Leeds at the weekend. Because they're just a very... they're just a very mid-table-y kind of team. And that's how they play. That's what they produce. And I think what's making it so hard for us as fans is that that makes it so difficult to kind of form a coherent narrative around the season and how good this team is or not. You know, we're looking for positive signs and then something bad happens and we're like, oh, it's confusing because we're kind of average. I don't know if that makes any sense, but it's like, I just feel like it feels like a roller coaster, but it isn't. It's sort of always the same.
Well, yeah.
But you know, what changes the results.
Sure.
But what we do doesn't really change.
What we do on the pitch, do you mean?
Yeah, like we do it better and worse.
Yeah.
But it's basically the same. And like, I feel like there's this interesting sort of discourse around like style of play. Like, what is our style of play? And I think that's a bit of a red herring. Like, I think we would accept the style if we were winning, whatever it was. Like, when we win, we're like, yeah, we won. That was good. And then we lose and we're like, oh, what's the style? Like, ultimately, it's this sort of contradiction of results are... how can I put it?
Yeah, well,
our analysis hinges on results, but really what we're analysing underneath is basically the same thing.
But doesn't, let's say, to take that particular point, if you have a coherent style, which, you know, we can try and identify or not, does that not increase your chances, assuming that that style is good, of winning games on a more consistent basis? Therefore, you're
elite.
I'm asking.
That's a big leap. Like, if we had a really clear style, like let's say our clear style was high intensity gegenpress, right?
Mm-hmm.
But we were losing half our games, we wouldn't be glad we had a clear style. I don't think.
But like, would you lose half your games if you were good at that particular thing, though? That's...
Yeah, but that's like saying, would you lose half your games if you were good? Like, if we were good at anything.
Well, yeah, sure.
But... yeah, I suppose it's sort of like a... I guess that's a tactical thing of, like, if you emphasise your strengths, would you be better off? Basically, this is quite a big ramble now, but basically, I think it's interesting that no one... it's quite interesting that no one can figure out what Arsenal are, but it's also not interesting because there's no consistent narrative around what we're doing. Do you see what I mean? It's like back and forward.
Sure.
But two steps forward, two steps back.
Isn't that in itself telling that maybe this is overthinking it, it's overcomplicating it, and what Arsenal are is a very average football team right now, and the swings from one side to the other are simply a consequence of that.
That's exactly what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Like, mid-table teams go on winning runs and losing runs.
Mm.
I mean, I've said this last season, but that is what they do. And Arsenal are a kind of upper mid-table team.
But isn't part of what's more frustrating about this season is that we've had a big investment in the summer, and one of the things that we wanted to see or needed to see or expected to see was a little more consistency, whereas what we're seeing is more or less the same in terms of... I think Scott did this on the By the Numbers piece on Arsblog News, where, like, I don't think it's particularly scientific, but you know that thing where you look at the amount of points you got from the corresponding fixtures last season, and I think we're about the same, or maybe a couple less. And that doesn't really tell you, you know... for sure what's happening one way or the other, because, you know, one season you can beat a team, another season you'll lose to that team. But, you know, it's very samey.
The thing is, yeah, that's a really interesting one, isn't it? Because if Arsenal's results this season were exactly the same as last season, I imagine people would be extremely unhappy. But I guess the theory would be, yeah, but the team we had last season was never going to get better. Whereas the theory, at least, is that this team next season will be better because of the age of the players.
Mm.
That's the theory. Now, I'm not expecting anyone to like that or enjoy it, but there, if you're looking for a silver lining, that's it.
Well, I mean, this time last year, after 15 games, we had 17 points, which left us 10 points off the top four.
Yeah.
And right now, we have 23 points after 15 games, and we're 4 points off the top four. So that's the way you measure a table. Not the corresponding fixtures. It's like, where are you this point of the season in comparison to last season? And it's better. I mean, it is better. There's no two ways about it. 6 points better, we're closer, et cetera, et cetera.
I mean, no one wants to hear this, but as awful as this feels, you know, we've, of the last 14 games, we've lost three. It's not apocalyptic, but it's just that, I think it's loads of things. I think it's that there are some deep-rooted concerns that are being borne out by some of these performances. Mm. I think that's a massive part of it. I also think there's just a lot of deflation and disappointment, because whether we like to admit it or not, we were probably all quite carried away. Not carried away, but swept up in the unbeaten run. Look at Saka, Smith Rowe. Aren't they nice boys? We liked them. We liked them. We wanted them to do well, you know. And we and with other teams faltering, Spurs having sat their manager, United having sat their manager, the goalpost did slightly move, because most of us came into the season going, top six will be a result. The goalpost moved and we started going, the discourse changed to, are Arsenal a top four team? I think we're seeing the answer to that question is no. Arsenal are not a top four team. I don't think they are good enough. They are probably what we thought they might be at the start of the season, potentially a top six team. So there's not been a dramatic change there. I just think it's the hope and the expectancy, and like you said, this litmus test of, are we good enough to leapfrog and to be in the Champions League?
Mm.
And a very resounding answer of no, probably not. And that feels crap.
Yeah, look, I mean, you said something earlier about, I can't remember, a scenario or a situation or a reaction to a situation that tells its own story. And I think the fact that we do lurch from, I don't want to say we lurch, because I don't want to speak for anybody else or speak for one section of the fan base or the other section of the fan base. But we, you know, there have been ups and downs. There have been swings and roundabouts this season where, you know, we've had some positive moments, we've had some really negative moments. A lot of it focuses on the manager. A lot of it focuses on, okay, well, oh shit, he's in trouble here. And then he does something and you kind of go, well, maybe, you know, he could be. And then it's like, no, he's in trouble again. You know, I think that tells its own story. Mm. That some of these concerns or worries or issues that people have are so deep-seated that it becomes nigh on impossible to sort of get beyond them. Like, you can plaster over them for a little while, but eventually they come back to the surface, if that makes sense, you know?
Completely, yeah. And I do think as well, the damage that was done in winter of last year with that terrible run, I think that and other things, issues with players, I think Arteta lost... The Europa League. I think Arteta lost a number of people along the road. And then when things get bad again, even for a short period of time, all those wounds are reopened. And if your mind's made up, your mind's made up as a fan. And I don't judge anybody for that. But it means that when you falter, you're in trouble.
Mm.
I mean, have we got any questions about if they should sack the manager? Because I feel like if we don't do that, people will feel it's the risk.
There was one from Ian Wright, not that Ian Wright, who's at IH Wright, who said, at all points when Arteta has been in a difficult moment, there's been an excuse that generously minded people could make for him. It doesn't feel like there are many excuses right now, though, does it? He's just not getting the best from his players. And was there another one? Let me see. Yeah, Lewis, for example, Lewis Ambrose, LG Ambrose on the Discord, he said, Mikel Arteta's contract expires at the end of next season. How good do the next 18 months have to be for the club to decide that he has definitely earned a new one? Where do we have to be by summer 2023? I mean, another one as well, Fenny, who says, Harry, your lad's an existential question. Do you believe anymore? Forget the trust the process line for a second. Do you believe in this project? And, yeah.
And do I believe in the project?
Because I do think that the question, like, should they sack the manager or not, is quite a reductive one at this point. But I do think that the question of his performance, what he's doing, and I think, more importantly, what he's capable of doing is a really important one. And
what's the timeline for a manager to get better? That's the thing.
Like, well, here, go on.
I was just going to say, like, it's completely legitimate and fair to criticise the manager. And it's also fair to say that you think they should replace the manager. But I also think there is a middle way which is sort of where I am, of being like, there are these imperfections in Mikel Arteta. There are things he does better than other things. There are things he's not doing very well. How long do you give those things to change?
Yeah, well, I thought about that this morning when I was writing the Everton the post-game blog.
Yeah.
And I think now that he's nearly 2 years, it'll be the end of December, he'll be 2 years as head coach / manager. And the biggest single issue I see with Mikel Arteta's teams throughout that two-year period is the fact that we don't score enough goals. We don't make enough chances. We don't score enough goals.
Yeah, I completely agree.
And I don't understand, from my limited knowledge of football as a fan or anything like that, I don't really see how that changes. I don't see how there's a switch which makes everything better.
You don't think there's a magic centre-forward that changes everything?
I don't think so. And it's not as if we're even seeing, like, incremental progress. It's the same, or indeed slightly worse this season. We're scoring fewer goals this season. I think our goals per game average is lower. So, maybe it's not. Maybe we scored more goals this season than we did at this point last season because we had that terrible run. But it is the overwhelming concern that I have about his ability to get this team to where it needs to go, because you're going nowhere unless you can score goals. And we don't score goals. And we've had a discussion about, you know, all of our strikers and forward players being in the shits right now. And I'm not sure who picks up the slack. And I'm not sure how the team becomes a slick attacking unit, because he's had 2 years now. And I think the initial question there about there's always been an excuse, and I think sometimes you could say there's been a reason why things haven't been good more than an excuse. There are reasons, and I'm not here to suggest that he's been flawless or anything like that, because I think part of it is down to him, but there are no more excuses. There really aren't. When you've been given the backing that you've been given, when you've been given the show of faith, when... Like, I think at this point, you know, the young team thing is a bit of a red herring. It's too much of a safety net for Mikel Arteta. I mean, I get it. We all get it. We all know young players are inconsistent. It takes time to build things. You're going to have bumps on the road. But it feels like another safety net where, oh, well, look, you know, what can you expect? But if other aspects of our game were improving, I'd be much more comfortable with games where it doesn't happen or we have a bad result here or there if you could see the fundamentals of what we need to do on a football pitch improving. And I struggle to see that, and I struggle to see where it's going to come from.
I hear
That's
you.
My massive, massive concern.
I
know?
Hear you. But we how can I put it? We have to, well, we don't have to do anything. Anyone can do whatever they like. But I do think that if we went back in time 2 or 3 weeks, rightly or wrongly, you and I have both said a lot of things like, Arteta seems like a different man this season. And he's doing things differently.
Yeah.
And we like it.
Sure. I agree.
And now, because we've lost a couple of big games, we feel terrible. And we're like, aha, the bad things were always bad. And that's human nature. But it's not black and white, is all I'm saying.
Sure. Like, I agree.
Like, is this just what getting... Oh, I don't know. Is this just what learning, a manager learning feels like? Like, they have periods where you feel like things are getting better and there are incremental improvements. Not big improvements. No one's lying about that. But then there's a setback and it feels like, oh, they don't know what they're doing. And then they get a bit better again. I don't know. And is that good enough? Probably not.
That's the question.
Probably not for a lot of fans. Like, it's weird, that thing of, like, how long. Like, if you... Like, Unai Emery got 18 months, didn't he? And he was, like, a very experienced coach.
Yeah.
So
Look, people say, and have often said, you know, look, when it was going wrong under Emery, you were more strident or you were more vocal or you were more decisive about what you were saying. And I think that's fair. But also, these are two very distinct projects, if you like. Emery was brought in as a, you know, a guy who could get us back into the Champions League, which he nearly did, to be fair, who could maybe get us...
He was a short-term appointment.
He was a short-term appointment.
So it had to work or not immediately.
Yeah, exactly, with some short-term signings. So the likes of Socrates and those kind of signings, you know, Lichtsteiner, you know, guys who are going to come in, make an impact now. Now. Whereas Arteta, whether people like it or not, has certainly developed into more of a project manager, maybe even in just the last 6 months. You know?
And also, but when you hire a manager who's never worked in that job, you are committing to a project of sorts. I mean,
exactly.
It could be argued that Arsenal, when they hired Arteta, I'm sure they expected an immediate upturn and they probably felt they got that when he won the FA Cup, etc. It's not maintained that sort of rise, if you will. Mm. But they might have said, I can imagine them thinking, well, in 5 years, he'll be the manager we want. But we're in year two. And it's like, how long into that do you keep going? It's a very, very difficult one. Because basically, after Emery, Arsenal have adopted a way of working that has a longer timeline. But as fans, our timelines don't really change.
No.
You know? Our timelines are, don't lose that game.
Yeah.
And, yeah, so it's so complex. And I can't tell anyone what they should think. As for Lewis's question, how good do the next 2 years have to be? I think he has to get into Europe in both years.
Well,
If
he doesn't get into Europe this year, he needs to go. Simple as that. If he doesn't get this team at least into the Europa League, I would say it's time for him to go. I would also say that if he gets us into that poxy UEFA Conference League, he should probably go as well.
I'm not being
flippant there, by the way. I'm being completely serious.
Right. Well,
Do you think there's any...
What I'm weighing up in my mind is what I actually think would realistically happen, you see. So I'm not convinced. I think he's very safe in his job, let me put it like that.
Maybe too safe.
Extremely safe.
Maybe too safe if he's, you know, if your theory from part one over some of the decisions that he's making about substitutions as a way to show
it's
his head.
That's speculation.
Of course,
for me. Who knows?
I said it was a theory. I didn't say it was the truth. You know, maybe that's a little bit too comfortable.
Yeah, I agree with that. I agree with that.
But I do think I'm just separating what I think would happen to what I would like to happen. That if Mikel Arteta does not get this team back into Europe, then it's time for someone else. There's no two ways about it in my mind. You know, that should be the minimum requirement for this season. And if it doesn't happen, thanks very much. You had 2.5 years. You had a huge amount of money to spend, because let's not overlook that. It's well over £200 million, at least. You know, when you add this summer spending and Partey and Gabriel from last season, you know. So he could never say that he wasn't backed financially. He could never say he wasn't backed in terms of faith and trust and support from the board or the owners or whatever it is. And even to a very large extent from the fans who did put aside that terrible run last season. When we got back in the stadium, I talk about the royal we, but when fans were back in the stadium, you know, the team was well supported, even though performances and points, etc., were well below what was expected. So I just think that this season, you have to, as a football club, have some, what are the things that they call them? Objectives or aims or ambitions
or whatever
it is.
Sure. Markers of success,
And there's got to be a minimum requirement, I think. And I think minimum requirement for Mikel Arteta this season is Europe. I think we're going to skedaddle our way through the next few weeks and we'll see what happens. It could be looking much rosier by the end of December. Or it could be looking a lot worse. Yeah, it's not off by any means. Yeah, so this is where we are with it. So,
Indeed. I've got to go.
I know. And I'm sorry we didn't get to more questions, but
I hope it was still interesting.
Yeah,
a lot of the questions were along these lines, weren't they?
There were some more, you know, like
what about Pepe and stuff like that?
What the hell? What's going on? Why? Yeah. Why?
Yeah. There's a few of those. There are a lot
of those.
Why are you bothering to do a podcast? Are you mental?
All those sort of things. All those. Well, look, there are big issues.
There'll be time for those, guys. There'll be time.
There will. We'll get to them. But as ever, thank you very much indeed for listening. I hope you enjoyed the show. May you live in interesting times and all that. So let's hope we can turn up against Southampton at the weekend. We'll have more podcast stuff during the week for you as well over on Patreon, preview podcasts and more, I hope. So for now, we'll leave it there. Until the next one, take it easy.
Bye. Bye.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.